This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. This is hour two of the program. The show is produced by Harriet Williamson. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In the popular imagination, the American suburb is a place that is mostly seemed to be as white, as middle class, and affluent. But in recent years, urban poverty has begun to move from city centers to working class and industrial suburbs. And perhaps there is nowhere that this trend is more evident than in East St. Louis, Illinois. This morning, in this hour of the show, our guest is Jennifer Hamer. She is Associate Professor of African American Studies at the University of Illinois. And we'll be talking about life today in East St. Louis, which is the subject of her book, Abandoned in the Heartland, Work, Family, and Living in East St. Louis. It is published by the University of California Press, and it is a place that she writes in the book, shows us the face of American poverty in the 21st century. And we'll talk some more about that with her this morning in this hour of the show. We'd be very happy to have questions, comments from people who are listening, all you need to do is dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So either of those numbers, depending on where you are. We also do have email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, if you want to participate that way, you certainly may. And we'd be very happy to hear from folks here. Just people, we'd ask them to try and be brief just so we can keep our show moving along. But questions, comments are certainly welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning. Okay. Glad to be here.
That statement that I grabbed off of the book, it's something that kind of jumps off the page at you, that East St. Louis is a place that shows us the face of American poverty in the 21st century. Can you expand on that some?
Sure. I think if you look at the latest data that comes out from the Brookings Institute in particular, has done a great job of summarizing what's going on. I think we well know that poverty is growing in the United States. And, you know, in the past, and typically when we think about poverty, we think about it and we're very comfortable thinking about it in the inner city and inner city neighborhoods. But what's going on today is we see the movement of poverty, and by that I mean it's growing faster outside of inner cities. It's growing faster in the suburbs of the United States, and East St. Louis and the Heartland is one of the places where we begin to see, in the middle of the decade, a shift in what suburbs are going to look like.
Yeah, and that's I'm sure that probably there was some people who might, when you say use the word a suburb, and you talk about East St. Louis, they're not going to think of those two things going together. I think though what you're suggesting really is that in many ways that East St. Louis is kind of an industrial adjunct to the city of St. Louis. So, in that sense, it really is a suburb of St. Louis.
Sure, definitely. Well, honestly, when most people think of East St. Louis, they think of it as part of the city of St. Louis on the Missouri side. It's actually in the state of Illinois. East St. Louis is a former industrial suburb, right? It's a place where industries set up to support their development early in the century. And it was really a city, some argue, that was developed not for residents, but for businesses. As we well know, businesses seek profit, and one of the ways they increase their profit margins is by paying low taxes and having cheap labor. And this is one of the things that East St. Louis offered to many, many industries early in the century.
Mm-hmm. So it was a place for people to work and industries to live, but it was also a place where industry could locate and have things that people in St. Louis didn't want to live next door to. Well, this was a place that they could get it not too far away, but get it far enough away.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a researcher at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville, Andrew Thiessing, who summarizes it in like this. He basically says that, you know, every city, every major city has a trash bin. And East St. Louis was a trash bin of St. Louis. It's where you have all of the pollution, where you have all the ugly industry, all the foul smells of the stockyards and the packing industry. That was East St. Louis. But at the same time, by the time you get to mid-century, it's a place where families are living, where people are coming to work and African Americans in particular are coming up from the South looking for work, but also looking for a place to live and educate their children.
Mm-hmm. And that's it has the kind of reputation that you talk about. But it seems to me that though that at least within, you can go back. You don't have to go back more than maybe a couple of decades, that you can continue to find a fairly stable, fairly successful middle class there. Or maybe you have to actually go back to the 1950s, really, before you see that.
Yeah, well, in East St. Louis, what you really have is a very solid working class mm-hmm. among African Americans mm-hmm. and a growing middle class among white Americans. And definitely, it is the case that you have a growing black middle class there as well, because you do have teachers, you have doctors, you have what we envision as a black middle class locating in East St. Louis. East St. Louis is really the place to be if you're African American and you're looking for a place to live, a place to raise a family, a place to work. Not that all jobs were in East St. Louis. You have people who were commuting to St. Louis as well and mm-hmm. In Illinois for employment.
Yeah. Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for this part of Focus. We're talking with Jennifer Hamer. She is an associate professor of African American Studies at University of Illinois. She's a sociologist by her training. And we're talking about some of the work that she's done in East St. Louis, which you will find in her recently published book, Abandoned in the Heartland, Work, Family, and Living in East St. Louis, and it is published by the University of California Press. Just to step back a little bit, that you write in the book how you, this really is rooted in work that you did for an earlier book, and perhaps maybe goes back to the time when you were teaching at SIU Edwardsville, which was close to East St. Louis. So there it seemed that it was a natural place for scholars to go and people who were sociologists and so forth to go and do work. Maybe you can talk about how this grows out of what you had, the earlier work that you'd done on African-American families.
Yeah, my dissertation work was actually on African-American families, and more specifically on African-American men who had never lived with their children. And my first position at a university was at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. And I took the position mostly because I was a single mother, and those are actually my roots, Edwardsville, mm-hmm. Illinois, which is about 15 minutes yeah. out of East St. Louis. And my work continued. I became very interested in East St. Louis because on the Southern Illinois University campus, there actually aren't a lot of black faculty, but you have a lot of students coming in from East St. Louis. In addition to that, because there aren't a lot of black faculty, there are many of the agencies in East St. Louis are always interested in working with researchers and scholars who are able to help them with grant writing and help them to think through some of the problems that are challenging the community. And so I was one of the people that was sort of drawn into the community through these agencies. And so my initial work in the city was actually working with agencies, faith-based organizations, trying to help them to get grants so that they could build labs for those who were interested in getting a GED, or for students, elementary school, middle school, and high school students, to help them with their homework. So that's really how I was drawn into the community. But I was also continuing my research on families, and specifically African-American men. But what I quickly discovered after spending time in the city was that you can study African-American men and men as fathers, but it's very difficult to understand the breadth of the situation and their circumstances without having a broader picture, a more holistic understanding of what's going on with families and communities. And that work essentially grew into a case study mm-hmm. of East St. Louis, and families and work in particular in yeah. East St. Louis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I realize here that this is a big question just to ask about what happened and how things changed. But as you said, there would have been a time when people would have thought East St. Louis was, not such a bad place to live. It was not a bad community. There was work. You might have to go to St. Louis for work, but there was work. And people thought of it as a good place to live and a fine place to have a family. Well, that's not the image I'm sure people have of East St. Louis now. What were the major factors that caused this decline in this place?
I think there are probably... It's probably very complex. So I'm going to try to make it very simple. Yeah. I think what you have in East St. Louis, as I said, it's a city that was really born to support industry, right? So you have that first and foremost. And many of these industries are located in East St. Louis, and many others are actually located on the borders of East St. Louis. So they're not actually paying taxes into the city. Those that are paying taxes aren't paying taxes into the city. But the city is supporting those industries. In other words, the roads that they build, the systems that the infrastructure that develops is really developed around those industries, first and foremost. Not that they don't support families, they do. So what we have happened for African Americans in particular is that they're coming in to East St. Louis, and you have white ethnics coming into East St. Louis as well, looking for work, especially from Eastern Europe and Southern Eastern parts of Europe. They're located in East St. Louis because of the work. But what happens, because it's a city that historically has been very politically corrupt, you have mismanagement of funds almost from the outset, and that doesn't change over time in East St. Louis. So that's number one. The other thing that happens when we get to the middle of the century, around in the late 1950s, is industries begin to pack up and move away from East St. Louis and away from its boundaries. And when they do that, they take whatever tax base they brought into the area with them. Those who are able to follow along with them. By this time, the city is already beginning to decline. So when industries begin to move, that tax base begins to move with them, the infrastructure of the city begins to be impacted quite negatively. White families, more than black families, are able to move along with the industry. Where are they locating? They're going to the south and further into suburbs, where they're attracted by tax incentives, lower taxes, and frankly, cheaper labor. They don't want to pay union wages. In addition to that, technology has taken off, and it's easier for them to move at this point. Mm. So that's where you really begin to see the shift. Once you get to the middle of the century, you see industries leaving, and the families that are impacted most are African Americans, who were the last ones to come into the city. They don't have accumulated wealth that would allow them to move easily and follow industries. They don't have seniority, so that may keep some of them from following industry. And of course, you also continue to have housing discrimination. So African Americans aren't able to live wherever they want to live. And so early in the century, you have African Americans coming into East St. Louis, and they're getting jobs, right? They're able to get work. And more continue to come with the expectation that they're going to get work. But when you get to the late 60s and the 70s and the 80s, even though many continue to migrate in, the climate is very different. It's shifting at this point.
Yeah. So this and it the kind of trends that you see in East St. Louis is the kind of thing we have seen in other industrial cities, particularly in the Midwest.
Well, I would argue that East St. Louis is a smaller version of St. Louis, a smaller version of Detroit, Michigan, for example, right? Where you have GM pull out of Flint, Michigan, for example, and leaves the city devastated. So yeah, it's very similar.
So were there other alternatives explored to try to provide a kind of a base of employment, a base for the economy there?
That's a very good question. A base for the property taxes. You had an increase in property taxes for those who remained in East St. Louis. You have other taxes like wheel taxes that come in, where you actually have to pay to park your car in East St. Louis if you're a resident of East St. Louis. So you have taxes coming in to support the infrastructure. But at the same time, those who were best able to pay taxes, property taxes, are leaving the city, right? And in addition to maintain property, you have to have employment. And so those two things sort of worked hand in hand against the maintenance of the city. Beyond that, certainly more recently, at the top half of the century, or I should say toward the 21st century, you have the tourist industry and casino, the Casino Queen, which is located on the river, on the Mississippi River, directly across from the casinos on the St. Louis side, on the Missouri side of the river. And so the Casino Queen, I would argue, was the primary answer to the problem or to the challenges of the city. It was not a success. It still did not address the issues. The city was in debt by the time you get to the late to 1960. The city's already in debt, and the debt continues to climb. And so the Casino Queen alone could not address the entire issue.
This was one of the things that just in talking about this with one of my colleagues, and here it was going to be about the show, and we're talking about what was going on in East St. Louis. That was one of the things he said. Well, how did that did that make a difference? Did that help the economy there having this as a draw? So the idea would be that people would come from wherever, Southern Illinois, Missouri, from wherever, and would go there and would spend their money, and that would also create jobs. Did it really do anything for the people of East St. Louis?
I wouldn't say that it did nothing for the people of East St. Louis. Some people were able to get jobs on the Casino Queen, but the Casino Queen employs people regardless of where they live. And so you have many employees who work on the Casino Queen who actually aren't from the East St. Louis. There are minimum requirements to work on the Casino Queen. In addition to that, once you get to 1990, the city is placed under receivership by the state. And under receivership, that means that the state now oversees the finances of the city. The city's budget is now held accountable, is accountable to the state. And so there's a financial advisory authority that makes a decision about how debt is going to get paid, who's going to get paid. And much of the Casino Queen's profits are the decision on what to do with them is not made by the city. So instead of going into the streets or street signs or streetlights, those profits may be going somewhere else. When you get to 1998, the Casino Queen's profits begin to decline because of the competition from other casinos.
Yeah, I think it's a good kind of case study, or at least maybe some people would say it would be a good kind of case study to apply to this question: does having gambling is that a good strategy for economic development of your area? And I think that a lot of people would have some pretty big questions about whether, in fact, that it does.
I'm no expert, absolutely no expert at all. I didn't go into the city to study the Casino Queen,
yeah.
So I don't know. You know, I don't have the complete answer to your question. But if you were to ask residents of the city, does the Casino Queen matter? The answer would probably be no.
What sort of things do people do to make a living?
Well, I think there's a misconception that everyone in East St. Louis is unemployed. Certainly that's not true. I think this is one of the points that we find in the study, is that the people of East St. Louis, despite all of the negative perception of the city, are people that you would find anywhere else, right, in the state of Illinois or across the United States. There are families, there are single parents, there are grandparents. You have all of that. And what do they do to make the living? They work just like everyone else does. The industries that they're typically located in are service industries. You may find them in the home health care industry, for example, teaching assistants, clerks in retail stores. But you also have professionals. You do have a middle class population. As we might define it for African Americans within the city of East St. Louis, you have teachers there, you have social workers there, you have principals of schools there, you have some police officers there, even though that's not a requirement to be a police officer. So it is not a homogenous place in that respect. People work there just like most people work. Unfortunately, 50%, about 50% of the population 16 years and over are not in the workforce.
Yeah.
They're not in the workforce. Only 52% are.
Yeah, that's really a pretty stunning statistic to say that among working age people, the unemployment rate is 50%.
Well, the official unemployment rate is 10%, right? But if we simply look at those who are not participating in the workforce, it's about 50%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also you write some interesting things about economies, formal and informal, and that I suppose when people think about informal economies, they're going to think about criminal activity, and that's, you have to say, well, yes, that is part that will be part of an informal economy. Except there are a lot of things going on that people are doing that do not involve doing something illegal, that they're doing to try to, you know, contribute to their resources.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think that changes over time. What changes is that they have to rely on these other sources of income. Now, you're absolutely right. When people think of East St. Louis, they think of it more of an inner city of St. Louis, as I said, and all that goes along with that, that it's very dark, it's very scary. And if you walk in there, you're going to get robbed, murdered. In fact, when I was at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville, the new faculty went through an orientation where they visited the East St. Louis Center of Southern Illinois University. And one of the things that we were told was it was probably not a good idea to come into East St. Louis after 5 p.m., right? It would be dark, it would be scary, and you're more likely to get robbed and carjacked, right? Mm-hmm. So that was really the image of the city. And so that is how people think of East St. Louis, as I said, like an inner city. But people find all kinds of ways to make a living when they have to. Certainly, you do have a level of crime there that you would have in any other place that looks like this. But most people are not involved in crime. They find other ways to make money. For example, they cut grass, they haul trash, they do remodeling, they fix appliances, they fix cars, you know, those sorts of hustles, right? Mm-hmm. And for women, and what I did find is the hustles that men and women did reflected what they typically did in the household. And so for women, you would find them doing hair, doing nails. Babysitting was a very big way or very important way that women found to make additional money. They would also cook meals for senior citizens. They would provide transportation for people who didn't have vehicles. So there were all kinds of ways that people found to make a living. But mostly what they were doing were filling the gaps, because East St. Louis is a place that lacks many amenities. And so how do you get the services that you need in a place that looks like this? And then how do you get them when you can't afford to purchase them? And so you find people filling in the gaps themselves, neighbors and friends.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how, you know, we've talked about the kind of image that a lot of people will have of East St. Louis. How do people who live there think about how it is that other people think of their city?
People of East St. Louis are very protective of East St. Louis. I learned very early that they were not very receptive to researchers coming in, and it didn't matter that I was African American. Simply didn't matter. Mm-hmm. It took a little while to actually enter the city. At a certain point in East St. Louis's history in the 1960s, they were the most researched city in the nation. And there are many people around today who remember that period of time. And from their point of view, researchers come in, they get grant dollars, they write a book, and they remember Jonathan Kozol's work on savage inequalities. And from their view, that portrayed the city quite negatively. And there's a lot of older African Americans in the city who think very poorly of researchers and what they've done to the city's image. And so they're not open to researchers, not really, and it takes a while to get in. So they are very protective of it. They do remember a time when East St. Louis looked different, when you had parks that children could go play with, and you didn't have high rates of crime, when the schools were very good schools, when Ike and Tina came and performed. You know, they remember those times, and they, you know, they're now living through this transition, a very, very long transition, and they're not sure where it's headed. So they don't appreciate the negative image. They're concerned that any researcher coming in is simply going to perpetuate that image. And as I said, they're very protective. You have students on this campus who are very protective of their city and very concerned about how people think about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, well, I'm sure that if the image of the place is that stubborn, that can be an impediment to change. Because it not only, as I'm sure, is it dispiriting for people who live there, but for anybody who might think about going there to live, to do business there, as long as it seems to be that scary place, they're not going to do it.
That's very true. And if you take a look at the Casino Queen, right, the Casino Queen is part of East St. Louis, but you don't have to go through the city to get to the Casino Queen. You can completely bypass it. You just ride along its outskirts. And in fact, to get to the Casino Queen, you don't even have to stop at a stop sign in East St. Louis. You just simply roll right through and get onto the and go to the riverfront. And residents of the city recognize that. They recognize that there's this privileging of outsiders in their city.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus is Jennifer Hamer. She's a professor, associate professor of African American Studies at University of Illinois. She's a sociologist, and we're talking about East St. Louis, and she spent quite a lot of time there writing about it and about the life of African Americans there, and she has put that into her book, Abandoned in the Heartland, which is published by the University of California Press. And questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455 and the toll-free 800-222-9455. Do people feel abandoned? And is that, I guess I'm interested in what you're getting at with the title of the book.
Yeah, I would argue that there are many who feel abandoned, feel that, well, there's a couple of things going on. There are many residents who feel that the city needs to clean itself up, right? In other words, East St. Louis is a problem. It wasn't always like this, and the leaders of the city just need to get their act together, right? But there's also, I think, a significant segment of the population that recognizes that industries left. No one comes into the city. No businesses or significant employers are coming into the city. In addition to that, many recognize, those who are applying for jobs recognize, that if you have an East St. Louis zip code, employers are not likely to hire. They're less likely to hire you than someone who lives outside of the city. So I think, yes, absolutely, they have this sense of being isolated and not having the support that they need. But I will say as well that I think that it's a very optimistic city in many respects. And again, you have this population that has lived through good times, mediocre times, and now the bad times. And they believe that there is a way to get back to a better East St. Louis.
Well, it's kind of hard to imagine, at least for an outsider, it's kind of hard to imagine what that would be. I mean, what are people thinking of that could happen that could turn things around?
I think for some residents express the need for the people of East St. Louis to do better. In other words, I think one of the things that, this is what you find, I think there are two things, and the same person can make the same argument, and I think this is not atypical. One, Black people in East St. Louis need to do better, right? They've almost accepted, in some respects, this culture of poverty. You know, it's our way of thinking. Younger generations don't value education. Younger generations don't want to work, right? Mm-hmm. And they need to do that. And so in that respect, they blame themselves, or at least younger generations, right? At the same time, they would argue that what we need to do is to attract industry to East St. Louis. So they recognize, right, that part of the problem is that we, East St. Louis, need to do something different as individuals. And I'm not going to say that I agree with that. But they also, to some extent, recognize the larger structural issues that are going on around the city that may be preventing it from moving forward. And then, of course, there's this third element of city politics, mm-hmm. that they feel probably should be addressed if we really are going to move forward.
Yeah, that's really, it's tremendously tough. And it seems like the thing you keep coming back again and again is to the economic issues, because if there aren't good jobs that will pay people living wages, you know, they're not going to spend their money on cars and houses and food, and there won't be the tax base, and then that won't be able to support city services. And certainly people may be familiar with that, the fact that the school districts are in a similar straits as the city government. And there again, it goes back to the same thing. If you don't have an economic base to draw from, you're not going to have good schools. And some people would be prepared to argue, if you don't have good schools, you really don't have, you can't have a community.
Yeah, that's true, right, to some extent. I wouldn't argue that East St. Louis doesn't have community. They certainly have a sense of community. There are neighborhoods that work together, that plant trees, that clean the parks. So you do have a genuine sense of community and a Black community. I think East St. Louis are very proud of being part of East St. Louis and being part of a Black city. Mm-hmm. So there is a sense of community, but you are correct. How do you sustain it when you have all of these challenges, from schools to employment to simply infrastructure? When you have streets that don't have stop signs, streets that don't have sidewalks, you know, what do you do with that? And where do you start?
We are talking this morning in this part of Focus with Jennifer Hamer, author of the book Abandoned in the Heartland, Work, Family, and Living in East St. Louis. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Mark Durr about the latest research on how wolves evolved into dogs. He's the author of How the Dog Became the Dog, From Wolves to Our Best Friends. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics tomorrow morning. It's our monthly show on nutrition. Celeste Quinn will host. Susan Kundrat will be the guest. She is a registered dietitian and is on the program once a month to talk about food and its effect on us. And this time around, there'll be a particular focus for the show, that is food and nutrition on a low budget. And in addition to having Susan as a guest, Jacqueline Hanna will be with us. She's general manager of the Common Ground Food Co-op. And then tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, we will talk with journalist Snigdha Prakash. She worked for a number of years for National Public Radio as a reporter, and she has just published a book that looks at the legal case against the manufacturer of the drug Vioxx. And the argument that some people made that it harmed them, and how that trial developed, how that legal case developed. She got some very unusual access to the attorneys that were representing the plaintiffs in the case. And she's written about this in a book that is titled All the Justice Money Can Buy. And she'll be actually here on the campus to talk about this and will be with us live in the studio tomorrow morning. You can look at the schedule by going to our website, will.illinois.edu. You can find out what we're doing for the rest of the week, and also that way you can listen to past programs you might have missed first time around. In this hour, the guest is Jennifer Hamer. She is Associate Professor of African American Studies at University of Illinois. She's author of the book Abandoned in the Heartland, Work, Family, and Living in East St. Louis, and it is published by the University of California Press. We have a caller. We'd welcome others, 333-9455. Also toll-free, 800-222-9455. The caller is in Champaign County here to start us off. Line one. Hello.
Hi. My mother grew up in East St. Louis and wasn't part of the early white flight. I have some experience on the ground there, but I'm still probably rather ignorant of it. But I was involved in going with an auctioneer to move stuff out of houses as whites were leaving certain neighborhoods. I did it a few times. But So I've had occasion this summer with my father getting treatment in St. Louis, they eschew the apartheid road and like to drive right through the old town. And I don't know how they react to it. I've asked them, but it's still frighteningly desolate to me. And I don't know. I'm rather unfocused on this now. But one of the things I'm concerned about is that with the Metrolink now, some of the developments around the stops, or, you know, some people are now taking that route in, and they maybe see a little bit more of the city, but they see a new development around Joyner Piercy, whatever her name is, I forget now, but and then you see the downtown. Those are the only two stops there, and I think some people might get a false impression that, you know, there is some economic development going on there, and I don't think it's actually supported. I'd like to be persuaded otherwise, but other than, you know, these pockets of development. But since my family always driven through a lot of times, my sister had the experience of, we were talking about how businesses were outside of town. The notorious instance is the Sauge community, which I believe is where Monsanto had a chemical plant. Sauge was actually the name of the manager of the plant, and it was basically created for, you know, to shelter the taxes, right? But the thing I wanted to to share is that my sister was driving through at night on Christmas Eve. And not only do they not pay taxes into the system, they were using the occasion of Christmas Eve to dump a lot of chemicals into the air at that very time. She drove like hell to get out of it, actually. It was horrible. And I don't know how you'll react, but Buckminster Fuller called it the worst ghetto in the world from a holistic point of view many years ago, and I don't know, from a holistic point of view, there's no explanation for that kind of poverty in such a rich nation. It seems to me everyone blames the victims, including some victims, it seems to me. So I had the blurt. Thank you.
Oh, all right. Yeah, thanks for the thoughts. You can react to that however you like.
Well, you actually mentioned several things that I don't think that we've brought up here yet this morning. I think you're probably talking about the Emerson development. That's what you see when you go past or you go down 64, I-64. You have the Jacker Joyner Kersey Center, which was for children that actually was closed, didn't stay open for very long. But you have Emerson development, and that's new housing construction. And when it was initially constructed, East St. Louisans were encouraged to move in, but they weren't allowed to purchase it, not initially. So just in the past couple of years now, they've opened up parts where people are actually allowed to purchase. When that was first constructed, the residents of the city were very encouraged. They were very encouraged to see this new construction going up. They were concerned that much of it was done by companies outside of East St. Louis. And they were concerned that they still weren't able to purchase housing, quality housing. And so I think you still have mixed feelings about the development, but I can say that East St. Louis were very thrilled to see, generally, to see new housing going up. But you are right that doesn't actually reflect what's going on in the city, right? The city is still in decline. In fact, just recently, within the past couple of weeks, residents were complaining about sinkholes, right? Not tiny, tiny sinkholes, huge sinkholes that when you drive through them, your car sinks into them. And the city's response was that they were simply unable. They just simply did not have the money to clean that up. And of course, now we have a winter coming along. And if we don't, and I think the response was, if we don't get to it by a certain date or before the first snowfall, we're not going to be able to fix them before next year. So we do still have considerable decline in the city of East St. Louis. You mentioned Sauget, yes, and Monsanto. Monsanto is one toxic waste site, but East St. Louis has 126 toxic waste sites within its border. And of course, that has consequences for the health of seniors, the health of adult men and women, and the health of children in particular. And you see that play out there. You have high rates of allergy and cancer in the city. So I think you're right. Your summary of what you're seeing as you go through East St. Louis is correct. It's a city in decline. It really is. Yeah.
Well, let's take another caller. We have somebody here in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a really interesting subject, and thank you for covering it. I was wondering, though, especially in light of the previous caller's comments about East St. Louis being in decline and, a city sort of on its way down, at least for the moment, I guess my question is a little bit more philosophical. Do these cities, whether it's East St. Louis, Flint, Detroit, what have you, or even organizations, do they need to start thinking about the end before the beginning? So, when industries are coming into East St. Louis, does the government of that city need to start to think about, okay, how long is this, going to last? How long is this sort of goose going to continue to lay its eggs so that, they can say of course there's a certain amount of risk, but they can say at least, okay, our people can have jobs, reasonably confidently for the next 50 years or 75 years or something like that. And then after that, we'll reevaluate once we get there. I feel like that would achieve the same results, in this situation where you would have a certain period of growth, a certain period that, is not as prosperous, but at least if you have that knowledge ahead of time, if you've done that analysis, if you've done your homework, so to speak, ahead of time, you can save a lot of people a lot of heartache, a lot of distress. And I know it's impossible to know for sure how long things are going to last, but I wonder if some thought being put into that sort of thought process could be beneficial for these cities, and then by consequence, you know, for organizations or for, you know, groups in general. Thanks.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about. I'm not even sure how to think about that. I think I would respond like this. I would argue that industries, major industries, should have contracts with places and people. In other words, I would say that municipalities and perhaps even at the state and federal level, that we require more of industry. You don't get to just come in, set up business, and have a place and people support your gains, right, your profits, and then simply walk away. I guess I just don't accept it as a given that industries have the right to do what they do. I think that we probably should have more control on industry.
Well, I think that, you know, you've talked about what happened here is the kind of thing that we've seen happen in other cities as well, when industry has left and the jobs have gone. And then the question is, well, what can take that place? And I think that there's some people who have argued that the really difficult thing is it's even more difficult than persuading those people to come back. They're not coming back. Those jobs and those industries are not coming back. So not only do you have to have something new to provide employment, but it literally has to be something new. That is, it has to be some new kind of business, some new kind of industry. Because it's not going to be what it was before.
Right. But I guess I would argue that regardless of the industry that comes in, that industry should be held more accountable and more responsible for the people and places that they impact. I think you're right. Industries aren't at this moment, what's the incentive for returning? In the late 50s and 60s and 70s, or late 50s and 60s in particular, you see industries leaving places like these industrial suburbs, right? And these central city areas in search of, like I said, cheaper taxes, cheaper labor, et cetera. When you get to the 80s and the 90s and at this period of time, they're leaving the United States. They're leaving the borders of the United States. And so early, you know, 50 years ago, they were impacting African Americans more than any other population. But once you get to the later parts of the century, they're impacting groups regardless of race.
Here's a question that's coming by email. Someone's wondering if the upswing that seems to be happening in St. Louis has any sort of benefit on East St. Louis.
No.
No. Short answer, no.
No, I mean, what's happening in East St. Louis, and I really do look at East St. Louis as the canary in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. If you take a look at what's going on in the United States, right, not just in East St. Louis and former industries, but take a look at suburbs and the growing poverty in suburbs, we've got a problem in the United States. Right. And so there it's not that there aren't upswings. Some suburbs are doing extremely well. But you have growing poverty in the United States and the challenges are very complex. And so there's an upswing in St. Louis. And it's probably not really impacting Black St. Louis, let alone East St. Louis on the other side of the river.
Yeah. We have about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus. Jennifer Hamer is our guest. She is Associate Professor of African-American Studies at University of Illinois. We're talking about some of the research that she's done now in East St. Louis, and she's written about this in her book, Abandoned in the Heartland, and it's published by the University of California Press. You know, you've talked about the economic decline and how that's affected the lives of people. You talked about how the official unemployment rate is about 10%, actually, if you look at people who are employed of working age, it's probably only about half. One thing that I'd like to have you talk about, because there's more in this book than we have talked about, and there's some really interesting things about particularly looking at men and women and at their roles and how they think about their roles and how they try to work to take care of their families. Well, one thing that seems really striking is that it's not just there is certainly a problem with poverty here, but there seems to be a particular problem with poverty among the elderly. And that's something that I think that you are trying to call people's attention to.
Yeah. In particular, I have a chapter devoted to women, older women, women who have reached retirement age or near retirement age and are simply unable to retire. They've worked all of their lives. They've been working class or working class poor for all of their lives. And their children are in similar circumstances. And what these women are finding is that they're unable to retire because they feel, and they do, have obligations to their adult children who are troubled in terms of finding steady employment or living wage employment, I should say. And they have relatives that they need to take care of. And so they feel sort of stuck, right? And one of the issues that they're experiencing is their own well-being. So they're women nearing retirement age or they're beyond retirement age, and they have all of the ailments that go along with getting older. And for African-American women, disproportionately, that may mean diabetes, hypertension, in addition to other diseases, cancer. You know, you have women who have cancer who are still in the workforce after the age of 65 because their paycheck, in addition to Social Security, helps to support themselves and their families. And the decisions that they make to take care of their family, to take care of their grandchildren, their adult children, their spouse or their sister, their older sister, are oftentimes put above the decisions for their own well-being. So they're more likely to take their grandchildren to the doctor, for example, than to take themselves, even when they're feeling poorly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And is there a high incidence of people taking care of their parents in their homes? It would that be at higher level than you would see other places?
You do. Well, you find that among African-Americans across the nation, right, regardless. But, yes, you certainly see that, and among low-income families as well. Right. But, yes, you do see that in East St. Louis. You see grandparents living in households with other family members or with grandchildren. And disproportionately as well, grandparents take being financially responsible for their grandchildren.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about how this, in a way, this grew out of some work that you had done looking at men and their role as fathers when they did not live with their children. And you, in fact, you wrote a book about that, and that you explained that you felt that as you looked more and more at what was going on with black families, that just doing that was just part of the story. There was much more going on. That was much more complicated. But as you say, that you have chapters in the book that are very specifically looking at men and women and men and how it is they see their roles and what it is that they're trying to do to take care of their families. And very clearly, women have this traditional caretaker role that they're always taking care of somebody, children, grandchildren, parents, and that they often end up coming last. They're the last ones taking care of themselves. In the same way, men have this real challenge that they have a particular idea about, well, what do men do? Well, men also take care of they're supposed to take care of their families, particularly taking care of their children. But it's really difficult if you're in a situation where there are constraints on your ability to do that, financial and otherwise.
Yeah, certainly. I think one of the things, I wouldn't want anyone to walk away thinking that men don't do anything in poor communities or in the city of East St. Louis, because that's certainly not the case. You see men involved in families and with children on many levels. You are right that one of the things that is expected of fathers is that they provide financial support to children, which is very difficult to do when you're unemployed. But that doesn't mean that men aren't providing something. It doesn't mean that they've simply abandoned or walked away from their children or their children's mother. They still are very much a part of families and family networks. One of the things that I focus on in this book is fathers. And by the way, there's a disproportionate level of single parenting fathers in East St. Louis, not just single parenting mothers, but single parenting fathers. And these men do what women do to protect their children. In many ways, if they don't have formal occupations, and many of them are working outside of formal structures to get cash and to bring food into the family. In addition to that, many of them serve as protectors of their families and of their children. So you'll see men walking their children back and forth to school, for example. You'll see them, because the city doesn't have the funds to tear down all the abandoned houses, you may see a group of men on a weekend or even on a weekday getting together to knock down an abandoned house or to clean it out or to get rid of some derelicts who may be residing there. You have an issue of wild dogs in East St. Louis, because East St. Louis doesn't have the funds to clean the streets or to keep that element off the street. So you may see men hunting down these dogs and protecting children from that element on the street. So men are very much a part of East St. Louis, just as they are everywhere in Black communities. I think it's a myth and it's an assumption. I think this is what the first book is about, mm-hmm. is Black men's involvement. Black men who aren't married to the mothers of their children, are they actually involved, or is it true that they are simply absent? No, it's absolutely not true.
Well, we're at a point, we have about a minute. Going back to something we talked about earlier, the fact that there would have been a time when people would have thought that East St. Louis was not a bad place to live. It was not a bad place to raise a family, and that it's certainly not the case now. At least a lot of people would say that it's not the case now. But you said that there actually are people who managed to find some reason to be a little bit optimistic. Although it sounds, I don't know how you do, given how bad things are. I don't know how you maintain some optimism in the face of that.
Well, I think we have to appreciate where African Americans come from. Right. So for many of, say, the senior African-Americans, they may be first generation East St. Louis residents, and they came from places in the South that were worse than East St. Louis. And when they came to East St. Louis, their mothers were raising chickens in the yard. It was still very rural, and to some extent, they watched their parents build the house that they live in. And so they've seen progress. And I think, so you have to appreciate that experience. And so they know that change. There's one thing about history is it always changes, and it's not going to stay negative and on the decline forever. So you can't appreciate their optimism. It doesn't do them any good to think negatively. And they do expect that things will improve. And they also invest in their children. They invest in their grandchildren. They expect better lives for them. And that's what you see these parents doing, is doing what they can so that their children have a better life than they have.
Yeah. There we'll have to leave it. The book is Abandoned in the Heartland by our guest Jennifer Hamer. It's published by the University of California Press. Jennifer Hamer is a professor in the Department of African American Studies here at University of Illinois. Also, she's the author of What It Means to Be Daddy: Fatherhood for Black Men Living Away from Their Children. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.